Thank you, Carlos. So I have to go first because the text that I chose was initially published in 1589. It is by Christopher Marlowe, who was a contemporary of Shakespeare's, a playwright and a poet, lover of boys, as he put it, and I believe tobacco, boys and tobacco, killed in a bar fight. At the age of 29, when I first went to college, queer theory was sort of this new thing in the 90s that was being applied to all kinds of historical investigations and also different forms of critique. And I was an English major, and so it was my brilliant idea to use queer theory to explicate a Elizabethan erotic poem called Hero and Leander by Marlowe. The poem is ostensibly about a heterosexual sort of myth, right? Though even as I tell it to you, you'll see the clues here. Hero lives on one island, Leander lives on the other. She lives in a tower, she's a priestess, and he swims every night to the tower to have sex with her, until one night the candle that she keeps burning goes out because it's winter time and then he drowns. In Marlowe's version, Neptune is so taken with Leander's sexiness that he actually kind of hugs him to death, and he can't make it to the tower that night. I'm going to focus on the initial description of the two characters. One of the things that was going on at this time also was a kind of vehement anti-theatricalist movement, meaning there were people who didn't want theater because it was immoral for various reasons, and of course there was the ban of women playing women's roles on stage, so little young boys did it. So that was also another reason that they, you know, created this situation where, of course, they had to ban theater doubly because it was encouraging male prostitution. So with that kind of framework in mind, I'm going to read this text. There might be moments where I feel this compulsion to explicate a little bit of it. If that's irritating, just do this. Yeah, it's full of classical allusion, as it were. I think you'll get most of it. So it starts with a description of Hero, I'll say the character who occupies the feminine position. On Hellespont, guilty of true love's blood, in view and opposite two cities stood, sea borderers, disjoined by Neptune's might, the one, Abydos, the other, Sestos' height. At Sestos, Hero dwelt, Hero the fair, whom young Apollo courted for her hair, and offered as a dower his burning throne, where she could sit for men to gaze upon. The outside of her garments were of lawn, the lining purple silk, with gilt stars drawn, her wide sleeves green and bordered with a grove, where Venus in her naked glory strove to please the careless and disdainful eyes of proud Adonis that before her lies. Her kirtle blue, whereon was many a stain made with the blood of wretched lovers slain. So her skirt was blue and had blood all over it. Upon her head she wore a wreath, from whence her veil reached to the ground beneath. Her veil was artificial flowers and leaves, whose workmanship both man and beast deceives. Many would praise the sweet smell as she passed, when 'twas the odor which her breath forth cast. And there for honey bees have sought in vain, and beat from thence have lighted there again. About her neck hung chains of pebble stone, which, lightened by her neck like diamonds shone. She wear no gloves, for neither sun nor wind would burn or parch her hands, but to her mind, or warm or cool them, for they took delight to play upon those hands, they were so white. Buskins of shells, she has boots, shell boots, all silvered used she, and branched with blushing coral to the knee, where sparrows perched of hollow pearl and gold, such as the world would wonder to behold, those with sweet water oft her handmaid fills, which as she went, would chirrup through the bills. So she has these boots that have these little mechanical birds on them. This is where I started to think that we were talking about a drag queen, right? I mean, this is what we're dealing with here. She also has a veil that completely covers her. Anyway, all right. Some say for her the fairest Cupid pined, and looking in her face was stricken blind. But this is true. So like was one the other, as he imagined Hero was his mother, and oftentimes into her bosom flew, about her naked neck his bare arms threw, and laid his childish head upon her breast, and with still panting rocked there to his rest. So lovely fair was Hero, Venus is none, as nature wept thinking she was undone, because she took more from her than she left, and of such wondrous beauty her bereft. Therefore, in sign her treasure suffered rack, since Hero's time hath half the world been black. Okay, Hero. Now Leander. Amorous Leander, the boy, beautiful and young, whose tragedy divine Musaeus sung, dwelt at Abydos, since him dwelt there none for whom succeeding times make greater moan. His dangling tresses that were never shorn, had they been cut, and unto Colchis born, would have allured the venturous youth of Greece to hazard more than for the golden fleece. Fair Cynthia wished his arms might be her sphere. Grief makes her pale, because she moves not there. His body was as straight as Circe's wand. Jove might have sipped out nectar from his hand. Even as delicious meat is to the taste, so was his neck in touching, and surpassed the white of Pelops' shoulder. Pelops was this kid that was served as a meal to the gods by his father. They didn't eat him because they figured it out, except for Demeter, who ate his shoulder. His shoulder was then replaced by ivory, so he had a really nice shoulder. But Leander's shoulder was nicer, okay. I could tell you, this is good, I could tell you how smooth his breast was, and how white his belly, and whose immortal fingers did imprint that heavenly path with many a curious dint that runs along his back. But my rude pen could hardly blazon forth the loves of men, much less of powerful gods. Let it suffice that my slack muse sings of Leander's eyes, those orient cheeks and lips, exceeding his that leapt into the water for a kiss of his own shadow, and despising many, died ere he could enjoy the love of any. So he's hotter than Narcissus, we get that. Had wild Hippolytus Leander seen, enamored of his beauty had he been. Hippolytus was chaste, he didn't love anybody. Aphrodite tried to get him to go with her, and he didn't. But if he saw Leander, he would have gone for it, that's what he's saying. His presence made the rudest peasant melt, that in the vast uplandish country dwelt. The barbarous Thracian soldier, moved with naught, was moved with him, and for his favor sought. Some swore he was a maid in man's attire, for his looks were all that men desire. A pleasant smiling cheek, a speaking eye, a brow for love to banquet royally, and such as knew he was a man would say, Leander, thou art made for amorous play. Why art thou not in love, and loved of all? Though thou be fair, yet be nine that thine. I'm sorry, screwed up. Though thou be fair, yet be not thine own thrall. So I'm just going to read a little bit of the next passage, which basically is a sort of festival where they meet. The wealthy men of Sestos every year, for his sake, whom their goddess held so dear, rose-cheeked Adonis kept a solemn feast. So they have a feast of Adonis, it's interesting. Thither resorted many a wandering guest to meet such loves, and such as had none at all came lovers home from this great festival. It's kind of like a gay pride, I guess. Okay, I'm going to kind of skip through this to the point at which... we are in the tower. And there's this crazy description. So fair a church as this had Venus none. The walls were of discolored jasper stone, wherein was Proteus carved, and overhead a lively vine of green sea agate spread, where by one hand light-headed Bacchus hung, and with the other wine from grapes outrung. Of crystal shining fair the pavement was, the town of Sestos called it Venus's glass. There might you see the gods in sundry shapes committing heady riots, incest, rapes. For know that underneath the radiant flower was Danaus's statue in a brazen tower. Jove, slyly stealing from his sister's bed to dally with Idilian Ganymede. And for his love, Europa bellowing loud and tumbling with the rainbow in a cloud, blood-quaffing Mars heaving the iron net which limping Vulcan and his Cyclops set, love kindling fire to burn such towns as Troy, Sylvanus weeping for the lovely boy that now is turned into a cypress tree under whose shade the wood gods love to be. This is like a psychedelic, crazy, gay allusions to every gay thing you ever heard of in any myth ever, all mixed up. And in the midst, a silver altar stood. There, Hero, sacrificing turtle's blood. She kills birds, and that's why there's blood on her skirt. Okay. Veiled to the ground, veiling her eyelids close, and modestly they opened as she rose. Thence flew love's arrow with the golden head, and thus Leander was enamored. Stone still he stood, and evermore he gazed, till with the fire that from his countenance blazed, relenting Hero's gentle heart was struck. Such force and virtue have an amorous look. And then there's this little summation at the end here. It lies not in our power to love or hate, for will in us is overruled by fate. When two are stripped, long ere the course begin, we wish that one would lose, the other win. And one especially do we affect, of two gold ingots like in each respect. The reason no man knows, let it suffice. What we behold is censured by our eyes, where both deliberate, the love is slight, whoever loved, that love not at first sight. Two are stripped, they look almost identical, like gold ingots, and yet, for whatever reason, we might prefer one to the other, and we don't have any control over this desire. Another contribution that Christopher Marlowe made is the play Edward II, and there one thing that happened also in the 90s was Derek Jarman made a film of Edward II, which was, of course, as an English major who was doing queer theory, this was a major thing for me. So I will just very quickly, if you'll indulge me, finish off tonight with a Act One, Scene One of Edward II. It's a story of a gay king whose lover is a French knight who was banished by his father and also by the court, a bunch of politicians who felt it was inappropriate for the future king of England to have a lover who was of a lower class and who also was a guy. But I think the lower class thing and the fact that he was French was actually a bigger problem. So this first little speech is Gaveston, the lover of the king, receiving word from the king that the king's father has died and now Edward II is in fact the king of England. So it starts, "My father is deceased. Come, Gaveston, and share the kingdom with thy dearest friend." Ah, words that make me surfeit with delight. What greater bliss could hap to Gaveston than live and be the favorite of a king? Sweet prince, I come. These thy amorous lines might have enforced me to have swum from France, and like Leander, gasped upon the sand, so thou wouldst smile and take me in thine arms. The sight of London is to my exiled eyes as Elysium to a new-come soul. Not that I love the city or the men, but that it harbors him I hold so dear, the king, upon whose bosom let me die, and with the world be still at enmity. Farewell, base stooping to the lordly peers. My knee shall bow to none but to the king. As for the multitude that are but sparks raked up in embers of their poverty, Tanti, I shall fawn first upon the wind that glanceth at my lips and bloweth away. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. Please welcome Andrea Geyer.
Hard to go up with a performer. Well, I chose a text that is part of a larger research that I'm doing. I've been looking at the three women who actually founded MoMA and their doing before 1927 when the Museum of Modern Art was founded. And I, like in the teens and 20s, and once I started looking, I actually discovered this unbelievable web of women, lovers, lesbians, patrons, writers, politicians, activists, who were all working really closely together and mostly communicated through forms of salons, but also letters that I've been digging into. So it seemed appropriate to kind of pick a text that is a tiny glimpse, or also in itself an object of this time, which is Gertrude Stein's portrait of Marvel Dodge. So Marvel Dodge was one of the patrons who was very much involved. She was very close to the Stein circle, but she was also very close to people here. She was very involved with the Armory show. She actually, Stein wrote that text in 1913, and then Marvel Dodge had itself published in 100 little things that she wrapped in wallpaper and as little booklets, handed it out during the Armory show. So I thought it would be good to look at this together. I also thought in terms of the kind of larger context of this reading, what's interesting to me is like Stein's portraits, all the portraits that she had been writing, this idea that they're outside of time. She's not interested in anything that kind of is committed to time or committed to memory, but more because she kind of says that memory and narration just repeat what happened. So it's not something that kind of creates a genius as she describes it. So she is more interested in describing things as I know them rather than as I remember them, which also seemed an interesting thing. She also describes these portraits as something that talk about less about the identity of a person but more about the entity of a person. So that's something that we can also maybe talk about. So bear with me. It's not so, yeah, I'll try. I'll do my best. The days are wonderful and the nights are wonderful and the life is pleasant. Bargaining is something and there's not that success. The intention is what if application has that accident results are reappearing. They did not darken. That was not an adulteration. So much breathing has not the same place when there is that much beginning. So much breathing has not the same place when the ending is lessening. So much breathing has the same place as there must be so much suggestion. There can be there the habit that there is if there is no need of resting. The absence is not alternative. Any time is the half of all the noises, and there's not that disappointment. There's no distraction, an argument is clear. Packing is not the same when the place which has all that is not empty. There came there the hall, and this is not the establishment. It had not all the meaning. Blankets are warmer in the summer, and the winter is not lonely. This does not assure the forgetting of the intention when there has been and there is every way to see some. There does not happen to be a dislike of water. This is not heartening. As the expedition is without the participation of the question, there will be nicely all that energy. They can arrange that little color is not bestowed. They can leave it in regaining that intention. It is mostly repaid. There can be an irrigation. They can have the whole paper and they send it in some package. It is not inundated. A bottle that has all the time to stand open is not so clearly shown when there is a green color there. It is not the only way to change it. A little raw potato, and there all that softer does happen to show that there was, that there has been enough. It changes the expression. It is not darker, and the present time is the best time to agree. Which has been feeling is what has the appetite and the patience and the time to stay. This is not collaborating. All the attention is when there's not enough to do. This does not determine a question. The only reason that there is not that pressure is that there is a suggestion. There are many going, and the light is not bent. There had been that little wagon. That is that precision where there has not been an imagination. There has not been that kind of abandonment. Nobody is alone. If the spread that is not a piece removed from the bed is likely to be wider, then certainly the sprinkle is not drying. There can be the message when the print is pasted, and this does not mean that there is that esteem. There can be the likelihood of all the days not coming later, and this will not deepen the collective dim vision. It is acknowledged division, that which is not any obstruction, and the forgotten swelling is certainly attracting. It is attracting the wider division. It is not sinking to be growing. It is not darkening to be disappearing. It is not aged to be annoying. There cannot be sighing. This is this bliss. Not to be wrapped and then to forget undertaking, the credit and then the resting of the interval, the pressing of the sounding when there is no trinket is not altering. There can be pleasing, classing clothing. The sap that is that adaptation is the drinking that is not increasing. There can be the lack of quivering that does not originate every invitation. There is not wedding introduction. There is not all that filling. There is the climate that is not existing. There's that plainer. There's the likeliness lying in liking likely likeliness. There's the dispensation. There's the paling that is not reddening. There's the reddening that is not reddening. There is that protection that is the destruction. There's not the present lessening. There's the argument of increasing. There is that is not that, which is that resting. There's not that occupation. There is that particular half of directing. There's that particular whole direction. That is not all the measure of any combination. Gliding is not heavily moving. Looking is not vanishing. Laughing is not evaporating. There can be the climax. There can be the same dress. There can be an old dress. There can be the way there is that way there is that, which is not that charging, what is a regular way of pain. There has been William. All the time is likely. There is the condition. It has been admitting. There's not the print. There's that smiling. There's that season. There's that where there's not that, which is where is what there is, which is begooling. There's a pace. Abandoned garden and the house is bigger. This is not smiling. This is comfortable. There's the comforting of predilection. An open object is establishing the loss that there was when the vase was not in this place. It was not wandering. A plant that was dry was not disturbing, the smell of burning, and altogether there was the best kind of sitting that could be, that could never be, all the edging that the largest chair was having. It was not pushed. It moved then. It was not that lifting. There was that which was not any contradiction, and there was not the bland fight that did not have that regulation. The contents were not darkening. There was not that hesitation. It was occupying. There was not occupying any exception. Anyone had come. There was that distribution. There was not that velvet spread, that there was a pleasant hat, that color was paler. The moving regulating is not a distinction. The place is there. Likely there's not that departure when the whole place that has that texture is so much in the way. It is not there to stay. It does not change that way. A pressure is not later. There is the same. There is not the shame. There is pleasure. In burying the game, there is not a change of name. There is not perplexing and coordination. The toy that is not round has to be found, and looking is not straining such relation. There can be that company. It is not wider when the length is no longer, and that does not make way. And that does not make that way of saying away, staying away. Everyone is exchanging, returning. There's not a prediction. The whole day is that way. Anyone is resting to say that the time which is not reverberating is acting and partaking. A walk that is not stepped where the floor is covered is not in the place where the room is entered. The whole one is the same. There's not any stone. There's the wider door that is narrow on the floor. There's all that place. There is that desire, and there's no pleasure, and the place is filling the only space that is placed where all the piling is not adjoining. There's not that distraction. Praying has intention, and relieving that situation is not solemn. There comes that way. The time that is the smell of the plain seasons is not showing. The water is running. There's not all that breath. There's the use of the stone, and there's the place of the stuff, and there's the practice of expending, questioning. There's not that differentiation. There's that which is in time. There's the room that is the largest place, when there's all that is, where there's space. There's not that perturbation. The legs that show are not the certain ones that have been used. All legs are used. There's no action meant. The particular space is not begooling. There is that participation. This is not passing any way. It has that to show. It is why there is no exhalation. There is all there is when there has all there has where there is what there is. That is what is done when there is done what is done, and the union is one, and the division is explicit visit. There is not all of any visit. Thank you.
Please welcome Chief Raganesh.
Hi. Thank you guys for coming, and thank you, Carlos, for organizing this. I'm actually going to read from two different texts, and some things they share include the fact that they both moved me very much when I was younger, and also they both touch upon, I guess, the way in which queerness is cross-cut by class, by location, and by the tension in deciding whether or not to name oneself, and the tension between inhabiting a marked versus an unmarked category, or a visible versus an invisible. So I'm actually gonna start with this one, which, oh, and I'm so excited I got to look at my old books and pull them out for this, so, and smell them, so that's really nice, thank you. I'm gonna start with this, a passage from The Femme Question by Joan Nessel. So just thinking about my own, how I located myself as a young queer person in this context of butch femme, which I wonder how is relevant now. So, The Femme Question. For many years now, I've been trying to figure out how to explain the special nature of butch-femme relationships to feminists and lesbian feminists who consider butch-femme a reproduction of heterosexual models, and therefore dismiss lesbian communities, both of the past and of the present, who assert this style. Before I continue, my editor wants me to define the term butch-femme, and I'm overwhelmed at the complexity of this task. Living a butch femme life was not an intellectual exercise. Deep in my gut, I know what being a femme has meant to me, but it's very hard to articulate this identity in a way that does justice to its fullest nature and yet answers the question of the curious reader. In the most basic terms, butch femme means a way of looking, loving, and living that can be expressed by individuals, couples, or a community. In the past, the butch has been labeled too simplistically the masculine partner and the femme her feminine counterpart. This labeling forgets two women who have developed their styles for specific erotic, emotional, and social reasons. Butch femme relationships, as I experienced them, were complex erotic and social statements. not phony heterosexual replicas. They were filled with a deeply lesbian language of stance, dress, gesture, love, courage, and autonomy. In the 50s, particularly, butch femme couples were the frontline warriors against sexual bigotry. Because they were so visible, they suffered the brunt of street violence. The irony of social change has made a radical sexual political statement of the 50s appear today a reactionary non-feminist experience. My own roots lie deep in the earth of this lesbian custom, and what follows is one's understanding of her own experience. I am a femme and have been for over 25 years. I know the reaction this statement gets now. Many lesbians dismiss me as a victim, a woman who could do nothing else because she didn't know any better, but the truth of my life tells a different story. We femmes helped hold our lesbian world together in an unsafe time. We poured out more love and wetness on our bar stools and in our homes than women were supposed to have. I have no theories to explain how the love came, why the crushes on the lean, dark women exploded in my guts and made me so shy that all I could do was look so hard that they had to move away. But I wasn't a piece of fluff, and neither were the other femmes I knew. We knew what we wanted, and that was no mean feat for young women of the 50s, a time, this is so ironic when I read it, a time when the need for conformity, marriage, and babies was being trumpeted at us by the government's policymakers. Oh, we had our styles, our outfits, our perfumes, and our performances. We could lose ourselves under the chins of our dancing partners, who held us close enough to make the world safe. But we walked the night streets to get to our bars, and we came out bleary-eyed into the deserted morning, facing a long week of dreary passing at the office or the beauty parlor or the telephone company. I always knew our lives were a bewildering combination of romance and realism. I could tell you stories. So
that's
the first. How are
we
doing on time? Was that one?
Yep, you're okay.
Oh, okay. And this is from Giovanni's room, which is amazing. So if you haven't read it, you should read it. And if you read it, you should reread it. Because it's that good. And this is also the beginning of this is, it's the beginning of the book, but it's also the narrator talking about his distance from marriage. So in both of these instances, I thought it was interesting that marriage was counterposed to queer life, which is not the moment we find ourselves in. Okay, it was several years ago. I was still in my teens. He was about my age, give or take a year. A very nice boy, too, very quick and dark, and always laughing. For a while, he was my best friend. Later, the idea that such a person could have been my best friend was proof of some horrifying taint in me. So I forgot him. But I see him very well tonight. It was the summer. There was no school. His parents had gone someplace for the weekend, and I was spending the weekend at his house, which was near Coney Island in Brooklyn. We lived in Brooklyn, too, in those days, but in a better neighborhood than Joey's. I think we had been lying around the beach, swimming a little and watching near-naked girls pass, whistling at them and laughing. I am sure that if any of those girls we whistled at that day had shown any signs of responding, the ocean would not have been deep enough to drown our shame and terror. But the girls, no doubt, had some intimation of this, possibly from the way we whistled, and they ignored us. As the sun was setting, we started up the boardwalk to his house with our wet bathing trunks under our trousers. And I think it began in the shower. I know I felt something as we were horsing around in that small, steamy room, stinging each other with wet towels, which I had not felt before, which mysteriously and yet aimlessly included him. I remember in myself a heavy reluctance to get dressed. I blamed it on the heat. But we did get dressed, sort of. We ate cold things out of his icebox and drank a lot of beer. I can't think of any other reason for our going out, and I remember walking down those dark, tropical Brooklyn streets with the heat coming up from the pavements and banging from the walls of houses with enough force to kill a man, with all the world's grown-ups, it seemed, sitting shrilled and disheveled on the stoop, and all the world's children on the sidewalks or in the gutters, or hanging from fire escapes, with my arm around Joey's shoulder. I was proud, I think, because his head came just below my ear. We were walking along, and Joey was making dirty wisecracks, and we were laughing. Odd to remember, for the first time in so long, how good I felt that night, how fond of Joey. I'm gonna skip a little bit and then just read a little bit. He looked at me with his mouth open and his dark eyes very big. It was as though he just discovered that I was an expert on bedbugs. I laughed and grabbed his head as I had done God knows how many times before when I was playing with him or when he had annoyed me. But this time, when I touched him, something happened in him and in me which made this touch different from any touch either of us had ever known. And he did not resist, as he usually did, but lay where I had pulled him down against my chest. And I realized that my heart was beating in an awful way, and that Joey was trembling, and that the light in the room was bright and hot. I started to move to make some kind of joke, but Joey mumbled something, and I put my head down to hear. Joey raised his head, and I lowered mine, and we kissed, as it were, by accident. Then, for the first time in my life, I was really aware of another person's body, of another person's smell. We had our arms around each other. It was like holding in my hand some rare, exhausted, nearly doomed bird, which I had miraculously happened to find. I was very frightened. I'm sure he was frightened too, and so we shut our eyes. To remember it so clearly, so painfully tonight, tells me that I have never for an instant truly forgotten it. I feel in myself now a faint, a dreadful stirring of what so overwhelmingly stirred in me then, great thirsty heat, trembling, and tenderness so painful I thought my heart would burst. But out of this astounding, intolerable pain came joy. We gave each other joy that night. It seemed then that a lifetime would not be long enough for me to act with Joey the act of love.
Thank you so much, Andrea. And finally, please welcome Thomas Lies.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for inviting me, Carlos, tonight. I have a text that's new. I know that part of the prompt was to kind of do something that was informative as a young person, but this feels kind of like a re-performance of youth, and a lot of the text feels like itself a kind of reenactment, which speaks to some of the ideas around memory that Andrea spoke to, as well as kind of theater that Alex spoke to. The story has some aspects that are intergenerational and involve kind of folks in the same family, and also this idea of marriage, death, and psychic loss, all of which felt like they were kind of part of the show and part of the things that had led up to the show. So that's kind of my preamble. And so the book is called, The Mechanics of Homosexual Intercourse by Lonely Christopher. And the story is the kind of titular story of the Book of Short Stories. Okay. The Mechanics of Homosexual Intercourse. Oh, also, the characters are called Dumb and Right. There's two characters called Dumb and Right. So those are names, very allegorical names, but just so you're not kind of confused about that. The calico couch was not where it had been a few months previous. Morton stood and examined his living room. His son, Dumb, sat inattentive in a chair that needed to be relocated. How was it? Morton asked of the general arrangement. The couch was against the wall with the windows that looked out onto the street. But presently Morton approached it and began to push it toward the space where the piano was. The chair Dumb sat in was by the door that led into the dining room, but it used to be led by the door that led into the entryway. Help me out here, Morton implored, nudging the couch closer to its old place. I don't want to move the piano, Dumb sighed. But it used to be by the window, and the couch was there, said Morton. Dumb helped move the piano slightly. It still isn't completely accurate, Morton said. The piano was only halfway to the window, and the coffee table was obstructing the door to the dining room. It doesn't matter, said Dumb. Let's see, said Morton. You were sitting on the couch with me. The lamp was... Oh, this is a new lamp. Let's put this in the other room. I think that the chair was by the other door. Dumb moved to the chair while his father supervised. Dumb sat down in the chair right after it had been moved. No, sit on the couch, said Morton. Wright was sitting at the piano. Morton adjusted the piano bench. We'll pretend it's where it really should be for now, but it's rather heavy, he said. Dumb stood up and walked to the calico couch and sat on it. Wright was here, Morton said, sitting down at the piano, and he sort of pawed at the keys every now and again and looked over at you. Move a little to the other side, please, Dumb. Yes. Now, he was sitting here giving you little looks, and, well, I remember he said there were two kids who were going to a shitty little high school someplace stupid, and the first kid came up to the second kid in the hallway in the middle school. It was Valentine's Day, and asked the second kid to be his Valentine. The second kid didn't like that very much because he didn't like some queer kid like the first kid, thinking he could never do anything with a boy when there were so many cheerleaders around with nice tits. And the second kid liked fucking tits, and he hated faggots. And so when the second kid did what he did was he went home, and the next day he brought his dad's Glock with him to school, found the first kid in the hallway, and then the first kid turned around and saw who it was, and giving him a look, the second kid fired a bullet into the first kid's neck, and he died. That's what he said, or that's an approximation. I suppose he was drinking wine. Dumb looked at his father. Are we done? He asked. No, said Morton. We have to reconstruct the event more fully. Dumb scratched his leg. But it doesn't matter, he said, because Wright killed himself. Morton stood up and attempted to nudge the piano in the proper direction. That's precisely why it does matter, he told his son. Dumb tried to think about that, then he scratched his leg again. Mom told me that her boyfriend in college died in a drunk driving accident, said Dumb. Morton sat down next to him on the calico couch and caught his breath. I know that, he said. It's how we met. Dumb didn't look at his father. Everyone dies, he offered. Don't change the subject, said Morton. Why are we doing this, said Dumb. To recreate the circumstances in which your relationship with Wright ended, so as to be better able to understand his untimely death, said Morton. It's a great technique, very effectual. Well, said Dumb, as he sat at the piano. He sat at the piano. He gave me little looks. He said mean things. He ended up having one of his seizures. That's right, Morton said. Then a few weeks later, he died. Dumb concluded. Morton shook his head. This is going to take more time, he said, but you're certainly not going to benefit from summarizing like that and skipping so far ahead. Dumb was bored. He tried to discover feelings of sadness, but that only confused him, so he didn't say anything. We can start with general questions, Morton suggested. Why did he have seizures? It was a medical condition, Dumb replied. What caused him to have an episode during the specific incident that we are investigating? Asked Morton. Dumb tried to think of an answer until he had too much to say, so he didn't bother. I'm going to skip just in the interest of time to make sure we get to the end. Okay. The calico couch was where it was before it had been moved back to where it was several months previous, and the new lamp was sitting on the coffee table by the chair. Morton and his wife Alice were seated on the couch, perusing two typed copies of a manuscript, when Dumb walked into the living room from the entryway. You're back finally, Morton exclaimed when he saw his son. What is it? Asked Dumb. Please take a seat, said Morton. Dumb obeyed suspiciously. I want to try a new approach, said Morton. That I think will be very therapeutic. Oh, said Dumb. Morton waved the manuscript he was holding in the air. I have crafted a dramatic scenario in which you and Wright are the characters interacting, with dialogue that I believe maintains a suitable fidelity to the actual language of your conversations insofar as I knew them, and pertinent topics, and dealing with depression, as are addressed in such a way that hopefully you'll be able to perceive the circumstances surrounding Wright's death and the consequent end of your romantic involvement with him from a previously unconsidered perspective that nourishes your emotional faculties and keeps you helps you process the change of that death of a loved one brings, he said. Well, okay, Dumb said. I'll be playing the role of Wright, said Wharton, and your mother will be playing the role of Dumb. Dumb nodded. Remember the notes on the line delivery I gave you, Wharton whispered to Alice, and we're not reading the stage directions this time. Alice nodded. I love you, she said. Wharton cleared his throat. How can you say that? How can you feel that when right now there's a 16-year-old pregnant girl getting raped with a knife by her father someplace? It's absolutely sophomoric, said Wharton. But we're sophomores, said Alice. You're not stupid, so I don't know why you're wasting your time convincing yourself you love people, said Wharton. It just happens, Alice said. It's a sociopolitical hallucination, said Wharton, and I disrespect you for valuing it so much. I'm sorry I can't help it, said Alice. No, you can too help it, but you don't, because you're under the delusion that love will make things better, or will redeem your meaningless life, and view it as some sort of contrived resonance, said Wharton. It's a feeling, not an ideology, said Alice. Then why do you try to predicate your understanding of your surroundings on it, said Wharton. Why do you attack me when all I want to do is be close to you, asked Alice. Because your spatial practice is fucked, said Wharton. At least I don't use pedagogic despair as an excuse to be so hateful, said Alice. We'll never escape the binary, will we? You love and I hate. It's uncomplicated as that for you all the time, isn't it, Wharton asked. I'm not the one who killed himself, said Alice. I was bored, said Wharton. You were depressed because you were so insecure. And all you wanted was ambiguity, but it prevented you from accepting the love I offered, and the struggle of denial became so difficult that you made a desperate decision out of weakness to kill yourself so you don't have to face your problems, said Alice. I'm not weak, said Wharton. You're not here, said Alice, and the only thing I can do is learn and grow from my experience with you, because I understand now that you weren't being theoretical, you were just being scared. Wharton and Alice both put down their manuscripts, and Dumb felt pressured to applaud them briefly. Oh, thank you, Alice smiled. I hope the ending wasn't too bluff, said Wharton, but you get the gist, I think. Dumb stood up. Do you want to have a discussion about your action now, or after you've had some time to digest it, asked Wharton. Said Dumb, in a while. Very good then, said Wharton, and he leaned over and hugged his wife. I think that went well, said Alice. Decidedly so, said Wharton. Dumb went to his room and closed the door behind him. He took a pill out of a bottle he kept in a drawer, sat down at his desk, and crushed the pill into a powder, then made several lines and sipped them into a piece of straw. He thought about Wright having a seizure on his floor and trying to resist when Dumb held him, but not being able to control anything as he shook. Dumb played Glenn Gould on his laptop and sat looking into his lamp until his eyes hurt, and then he turned the lamp away. Walter was an older cousin of Dumb's, a thin, effeminate man who lived in a small apartment far uptown, and his impending marriage to his lover Nicholas became the source of much excitement and preparation as the date of the ceremony drew near. Walter was beholden to Wharton, who contributed an undisclosed sum to partly funding the wedding, and so he felt obliged to always accept the invitations to dinner that Wharton enthusiastically extended to him and his fiancée. One night, the couple was a guest of the household, and everyone sat around the dinner table as Alice brought in dishes of food from the kitchen. Did you ever resolve the issues with the cake? Asked Wharton. Oh, said Walter, we took a bath on that awful bakery. They're just a bunch of scam artists. Now we're basically back to square one with the cake. Nicholas shook his head in frustration. He said, we were better off when none of this was allowed. Walter touched the back of his fiancée's neck. Nicholas is just a wreck this week, but he knows there's nothing better than the likes of us to put on a show in style. We're not worried about the cake. Can you believe that when Wharton and I married, we just eloped, said Alice. We thought we were being progressive, but we were really just trying to alienate our parents, Wharton commented, pouring a glass of wine. I suppose that's what we're doing in a way, too, said Walter. Oh, you know your father is very proud of you, said Wharton. He just has a hard time communicating his feelings. Or lending any support, muttered Nicholas. Oh, stop that, Walter said to his fiancée. We're lucky for what we have. Let me know if we run into any more snags, said Wharton. We're doing fine considering the time crunch, said Walter. The cake is well, we're gonna fix the cake problem. Don't fret. Oh, Dumb, said Nicholas. Be sure to let us know who you're bringing so we can finalize the seating arrangement at the reception. Dumb thought about it. I'll bring my friend Lucy, and I think my friend Orange, he said. Yes, Alice and I recently met this boy, Orange, said Wharton. It's a very positive step. Oh, said Walter. Dumb is bringing his girlfriend and his boyfriend. I remember when you were 5 years old, Dumb. Dumb smiled. He tried thinking about what it was like to be 5 years old. That's funny, he said. So the next part, Dumb comes back as a ghost and talks to, Wright comes back as a ghost and talks to Dumb. So I'm going to skip that, but basically at the end of it, Dumb invites Wright to go to the wedding as a ghost. So this is the wedding with the two of them together. The small cathedral was crowded with friends and relatives for the ceremony. Morton and Alice sat in the front pew next to Walter's father, a widower, whose visible reaction to the event was witnessed. Vacillated between disbelief and pride. "I never thought it would be like this," he muttered, overheard by someone nearby. Wright scowled, but could say nothing. Dumb had never seen Wright dressed formally, but thought he looked handsome and healthy, despite his suicide. Lucy sat in between the two boys, holding Dumb's hand. Walter and Nicholas stood together, in front of everyone, led through vague and familiar rituals by a wrinkled priest. Both men were teary when they read their personal vows to one another. Soon it was declared that they were officially married. They kissed, marched down the aisle of the small cathedral, and out of the church through a large set of red doors, followed closely by the crowd, which paraded down the front steps cheering, before dispersing in the street to travel to the reception. As Dumb walked down the stairs with his two friends, he asked Wright, "What do you think?" Wright watched the newlywed couple holding hands, posing for photographs before entering into an awaiting limousine. "I guess it's like anything else," he replied. "You're in a good mood," said Dumb. "I don't think I can go to the reception," Wright said. Then he turned without looking at Dumb and walked out of the crowd, leaving for his hermitage. "And they never saw him again," muttered Lucy. "Oh no," Dumb said. "A seat at the table will be empty." "He sounded regretful, at least," said Lucy. Dumb watched as Wright disappeared around the corner. "Now what?" asked Dumb. "I don't know," Lucy replied. "I guess everything just keeps happening," said Dumb. They walked. "That was a fine wedding," remarked Morton to his wife as they watched Walter and Nicholas leave in the limousine. "It almost makes me wish we had gone through the trouble," Alice said, "when we were that age." "We had a fun time anyway," said Morton. "But there's something to be said for ceremony," Alice suggested. "It really makes one feel a special part of something." Morton kissed his wife gently, told her he loved her, and then they walked.
Could I ask the readers to come back up here?
What's that?
Yeah, in the interest of time, so that we can have some time, Ryan and I will not read. But please come here.
Could you hear?
Thank you so much. That was really beautiful from everyone. And I think one of the things that motivated me to invite you to do this was, in a way, a kind of reflection of my teenage years. And wanting to desperately find a space of identification somewhere that was completely denied in school or to anyone around me. And it was only through finding books that I understood that there was another context for the way that I felt, the way that I wanted to think politically. So I just kind of want to throw out that notion out there in the choice that you made in your life and how you chose to subscribe to certain ways of thinking and how you may have found certain degrees of identification and in a way, I suppose, validation as a human being through literature. And to open up also this notion of the political potential of writing and how these things kind of line the page in ways that are codified and in a way acceptable in society, but also incredibly subversive and that open up a space for living a freer life. So I just want to kind of ask you if you have anything to comment and then immediately open it up for some of you in the audience to share a story or if you have a question or whatever you want to contribute to this forum. If you don't want to answer, you don't have to.
I guess the question, I mean, I don't know, I'm just thinking probably everybody has an answer to this question in the room, but yes, it was particularly important. I mean, it's interesting now, I wonder, having, you know, because this question leads us back to sort of childhood, youth, etc., there were a lot of different ways to access this kind of identification. So the fact that there was like a video store nearby that had, you know, A Room with a View in it and John Waters movies was important too. But I remember, you know, of course, discovering Jean Genet in high school and, you know, directing 10th grade production of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof by Tennessee Williams, where the entire plot hovers around the suicide of a gay boyfriend. I was the director, so I decided I was the gay boyfriend. You know, I mean, there were so many different places where I guess it was about kind of carving out that space too, but it was you know, I think it might be different now. But literature does allow for that kind of projection. And there is that very personal sort of identification, and I think also the need to be alone sometimes as a teenager, which is what I'm thinking about. But then in terms of the sort of political discussion, it's interesting because to me a lot of the figures, the literary figures that I was from the 20th century, you know, that were sort of on offer, when I think about the people that I could have read from, Mishima, later Fassbinder is a huge influence, all of these sort of romantic figures who die in some like amazingly awesome gay way, Marlowe of course dying in a bar fight, but the politics there being kind of problematic, and it was actually like my parents' 60s folk music collection that led me to an understanding of politics, and I would say it was Buffy St. Marie pretty much.
Well, I think one thing that I read the Emma Giovanni's Room in 1989, and I read the other one, the first piece I read in 1992, myself. And I remember reading the Joan Nestle piece and being like, oh, she's been out for 25 years? I can't believe it. And 20 years later, it's like, you know. So there's also this whole question of time that I think I wanted to return to with these texts, and how some of the things that really struck me are timeless, and how at the same time others of them are so much of a particular time, of a time when marking yourself in categories really had a much greater valence in how someone articulated their queerness or found community. Also in terms of how much it was connected to class and sort of positioned against marriage. I think those are parts of the plot that have gotten lost that I would like to retrieve. So that's, and also just to try not to lose the plot myself as I, you know, barrel into middle gay age and everything that means for me. So those are some of the things that I was thinking about, and also just the way literature can encompass this incredible complexity and contradiction, and like from the very beginning, you know, James Baldwin talking about like the shame and the terror and the joy and the peace, like all in one sentence. I mean, and over again, it really made me see the potential of how inextricable so many of these things are.
Yeah, I think there's something about what you're describing, Carlos, that feels particularly pitched for folks that, like, you know, gay boys that grew up in the 80s, at least I've, you know, has that, I feel that way, just in terms of the kind of break that happened with an earlier generation because of, you know, loss of life, and obviously there's kind of, you know, that's a very particular and highly, you know, narrativized experience, but there are many others that are queer, you know, in different ways that kind of speak to that, and so I think that kind of loss and that kind of incapacity for self-representation feels particularly, you know, hyperbolized in that, and so that's why this kind of, you know, even though the text I read is not about necessarily AIDS, there's a way that for me, like ghosts, just in general, feel like they're this kind of haunting force that speaks to the ways that pain and shame related to, you know, the loss of a community kind of sediment in a collectivity, in a kind of social body, and then kind of find funny ways of manifesting themselves so that, you know, gay marriage becomes kind of like this promise for being able to shed the shame of the 80s in a certain kind of a way. So I think to me, you know, there's a way that literature function, you know, even the kind of coming out story that you told, I feel often, still now, like just feelings of kind of not quite seeing forms of self-representation of my own desire in the world, and so kind of looking to text and the kind of perversions that can occur in that very intimate moment as a way to kind of explore that. But in a way that's both very solitary and social, in that, you know, like we know the smell of those old books. It's like, it feels like it's a, you know, it's the same book I stole from my mom's shelf that you were reading to earlier tonight. So there, while on the one hand it's very, can feel very individualizing, it can also feel like something that obviously brings people together like this.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking similarly that for me there have been all these kind of continuous layers of identifying myself as a queer and as part of a queer community. I think when I grew up in Germany, there was a lot of like the lesbians that I then at a certain moment recognized, there was a lot of disidentification with that. I was like, okay, I feel that way, but I do not feel that way. And there was really like confusing. So this kind of growing into these spaces that now I see those lesbians and I'm have like, I think they're fantastic, you know? So I think that there is, because they've aged with me in a certain way, and there's, and then coming to the US in the mid 90s and the AIDS crisis that was really differently present in this place than where I was before. So it's a continuous growing moment, like the more we let this community unfold and unpack itself and become visible. So I feel like it's always hard. Of course, there's the one moment where you recognize in yourself something, but then that keeps and continues to grow. What's interesting for me is to look back to this much earlier moment in my research is, it makes me think about the way in which we historicize our community, in a way, like always from the present in this kind of continuous way, and how, you know, today a certain kind of what makes a queer, or this kind of idea of assimilation through marriage and family and this kind of trying to be fit in, instead of where I look back at Stein and she's like trying very hard to not use any of the tools that I would make her slip into that, but trying to find a new language that actually allows her to express her relationship to somebody like Mabel Dodge, you know, and maybe they were lovers, who knows, you know, I mean, there was a lot going on back then, especially in that generation, because they were like raised in the Victorian age still a little bit with those values. I think the women that are like 10 years younger than them had a very different relationship and were much more flamboyant and went to Paris and lived a different kind of out queer life than her and Lily Bliss, who's one of the founders of MoMA, who was very likely a lesbian, what we would call a lesbian today, but probably didn't think of herself that way, or maybe not in different ways. So I'm really interested in being very critical about the way we construct ourselves today through these kind of histories, and to be more, actually more proactive about finding forms, languages, images, literature that actually allows the complexity that this community is made out of to exist, rather than trying to kind of fit it in something that already exists.
Yeah, I guess one of the other things that I was thinking about in relationship to these ideas is how there has been a kind of narrativization of the perfect queer story in the mainstream, right? And I feel that it is still books the place where these openings occur. For example, in the recent publishing of Gail Rubin's Deviations, in a time period in which deviant sexualities, sadomasochism, you know, all of this kind of queer other forms of experiencing sexuality have been relegated as something that is not even talked about because it doesn't fit the paradigm of the homosexual story that we need to conform to politically and strategically. And I find that there is, you know, it is still the book, and also the club and the bar and so on, and the private party, of course, but and the radical fairy gathering, since I see you here. but it's still the book, the place that allows for that opening. So I don't know if anyone in the audience wants to jump in with some contribution. It would be great if you could use a mic, but you don't have to. It's just because it's being recorded. Thoughts or questions? Elaine.
Just, are you writers? Have you written your own? I'm not familiar with your work, so I'm new. I'd like to know what you've done.
Yes.
I worked in performance and write. So for me, I mean, one of the reasons to go to Marlowe, but you know, another person I could have gone to in terms of a direct identification across you know, the time Doctor Who's time machine would be Oscar Wilde. But yeah, I write for performance primarily, but I write, and so it is this use of text and language as a kind of provocation of desire, as well as a kind of frustration of language itself, that was really interesting to me about these texts. But also, I think in all these cases, for me, where that sort of attraction is in the word. And, you know, presenting performance within an art context, a lot of the time, there is this sort of privileging of the silent performer, or at least a space, you know, for that, which is, of course, important. But I am actually very interested in speaking subjects. And so, you know, these writers provide a kind of model for that. And also for, you know, the ways in which language fails us. That, too, I think is something we have to confront. One other thing is just that I don't come from a family where English was the only language spoken, so I think that was a reason, particularly for me, that Elizabethan poetry is so interesting, because it's so incredibly hard to understand. But it's also where all the cliches come from that we still use in Katy Perry songs.
We could also open up for another.
Yeah, sorry.
I think everybody deals with writing in one way or another.
Thank you.
Elaine, you want to say something?
I just have a comment. And what was wonderful to hear each of you read is it almost became a script in itself. Mm-hmm. That just kind of intermixed over the course of the evening. So that's what I really appreciate. And lots of memories.
Was there any instruction to choose fiction?
No.
Coincidental.
I want to know what you wanted to read from the Two Knives.
Yeah, were you going to read that?
I was going to read a little bit. Go ahead, and I'll respond to the section.
I think it's interesting to think about like these, like when you go to theory in terms of one's own kind of identification as an artist. For me, like, I think there was, my other book was, there's this passage in, sections in Judith Butler's Giving an Account of Oneself that talks about this kind of not knowing of the other that creates an ethical relationship that I think is really important in terms of talking about community. But it's not in that way, for me, it's not so much a text of identification, but a text of kind of growing and with the writer who writes the theory. And I like these moments where you kind of cling to something, and even though the Stein is to a certain, Ghetto Stein is to a certain degree completely incomprehensible, what you comprehend is not the literalness of the language, but the kind of feeling of the text at large. And I think that's something that is like part of literature rather than theory.
I also, was my alternate text was a passage of Judith Butler about the performative nature of heterosexuality. But I think that there's something about these informal networks of discussion, such as storytelling, that exceed the canon and that it sometimes exceed published work, that is really central to collectively generating narratives for multiple communities. And I think that in terms of giving the audience pleasure and also thinking about the audience, that was one of the reasons that I chose fiction, because it's a good form for this storytelling that is often just in the realm of rumor and gossip, which is how we found out that there were more like ourselves.
I am being told by the museum police that we have no more time.
Oh, but it should be like 2 minutes. We should close it.
I'll just close it.
Yeah, great.
It's okay?
Yeah.
A minute. Well, I was actually going to read the whole thing of Postcards from America, X-rays from Hell, but there's no time. So I'm just going to maybe read a few passages. 2 minutes, right? 1 minute. 45 seconds. Okay, yeah, I don't. I'm sorry. Just this one. A box cassette of someone's interview with me in which I talk about diagnosis and how it simply underlined what I knew existed anyway. Not just the disease, but the sense of death in American landscape. How when I was out west in summer standing in the mountains of a small city in New Mexico, I got a sudden and intense feeling of rage looking at those postcard perfect slopes and clouds. For all I knew, I was the only person for miles, and all alone, I didn't trust that fucking mountain's serenity. I mean, it was just bullshit. I couldn't buy the con of nature's beauty. All I could see was death. The rest of my life is being unwound and seen through a frame of death. And my anger is more about this culture's refusal to deal with mortality. My rage is really about the fact that when I was told that I'd contracted this virus, it didn't take me so long to realize that I'd contracted a diseased society as well. Thank you so much for coming.